volunteering at an after-school program or choosing to run for an elected office. I think democracy demands all of our talents and skills to be actively involved in our society. And it does not start and begin with just running and voting. It starts with us getting outside of our comfort zone, coming outside our homes, and really trying to engage our environment, our neighborhood, and in real ways to see how we can use our skills and our talents and our perspective and our energy to make all of our lives better.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. My guest today is the Pennsylvania State Representative for most of the Pittsburgh region. We get into some very specifics about the 19th District, but Representative Jake Wheatley has been in this position for 15 years now and has seen and had an influence on the reshaping of Pittsburgh as a tech and startup hub within the Midwest. He also has a lot of experience both in the military and in public life informing what he does now. We went on a half-hour conversation about his background and some of the leadership principles that he's both had to learn and apply in public life. I thought this was a really interesting career arc and slightly different than some of the more recent episodes that we've been doing in the more entrepreneurially focused vein. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jake Wheatley.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thank you for agreeing to do this. To me, one of the most interesting places to start for you is about getting into the Marines.
Sure.
And eventually getting out and moving on to the next step. But tell me about when you first enlisted and your deployment in the Marines.
Sure. So I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. And I grew up in a household where my parents, they're both from little small towns in Mississippi. And my dad was a former Army, and my mom worked for 30-something years as a United Auto worker. And I knew, they knew that they wanted all of their children to go on to college. And as a young student, my mom and dad separated when I was about 13 or 14. My mom's job moved us to Minnesota.
She just kept getting colder and colder.
Yeah, I know, right? But while in Minnesota, I played sports. And I always thought that I was going to end up in a professional career in sports, football. And I went to school at St. Cloud State University. But what I discovered when I was at St. Cloud State University is that I wasn't prepared from a discipline perspective to be at the university. So I ended up leaving early. And I entered into the Marine Corps. It's just by chance. When I came home, there was a commercial. And it was one of those great commercials that the Marines do. And they were talking about seeing the world, paying for school, and developing you as a human. And I joined right away. And the guy asked me when I went down to sign the paperwork, he asked me, what did I want to do in the Marine Corps? And I thought a career in communication sounds like something very interesting. So I said, I want to be communication. So when I got to boot camp, after I finished boot camp, they were like, well, they're sending me to 29 Palms. I was like, is that where I'm going to learn to, you know, type and so on and so forth? They were like, no, you're going to be a field radio operator. That's what the communication sounds like. I mean, that's what a communication job in the Marine Corps is. And I said, what is that? They said, well, all Marines are infantry. You're just going to be infantry with a 25-pound radio on your back.
Oh,
so I ended up enjoying that career. I was attached to an artillery unit, and basically my job was to go in front of my unit and put a sight on a target and call in artillery support or air support or naval support. So it taught me some wonderful skills, definitely.
The discipline part, discipline is a universal skill set, whether you are in politics, in business, in athletics, in the military. Can you talk a little bit more just about your development as it pertains to discipline, how you learned that in the Marines and how that's translated in what you've done since?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't have a straight and narrow road to where I am, right? I was, even though I had very caring parents and a nurturing household, I was always one of those kids who wanted to push to the limit. And I couldn't learn by just being told something. I was one of those kids who would actually touch the fire, even though the mom said, "Hey, you're going to burn yourself." So as a young man, I was very undisciplined. Even in the athletics, even though I was good in sports, I couldn't follow directions. I was always combative with authority. And all those things didn't play well when you enter into the Marine Corps, which is one of the most organized and disciplined of all the branches. And so I had to really learn and grow. And it took a long time, but I had some caring mentors in the Marine Corps. I had a first lieutenant who, when I first got to the Persian Gulf, and because of the job I did, we were be attached, detached from our unit, and would be attached to other units. So in that experience, I had an incident that really helped kind of bring this whole focus of discipline back to me, where I refused to do something that I was told to do. And in times of war, when you do that, that's not the best course of action. And this lieutenant who was with me, instead of being real aggressive and trying to punish me, what he did was he gave me two books that changed my whole world. One was the Art of War, and one was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And when I read those books and kind of really internalized the messages of them, it really helped shape me into become more of a focused, disciplined individual. That not all battles are won. No battles are really won from emotional responses. To have a plan of action, a course, to be able to control oneself to achieve things, and to understand when you go through something, it doesn't mean that just because things aren't working your way or they don't turn out your way, that you should give up. So that experience, plus just meeting more men from different parts of the world, different parts of the country, coming from different experiences, and all having one centralized goal, and that's working as a unit to achieve something, and seeing the power of that. And that all helped change my perspective, I think.
It also seemed like throughout the process, even if you were maybe undisciplined at the beginning or needed to learn that lesson, that you were absorbing the stuff. It wasn't just bouncing off you. Yeah. Maybe bounced off a couple times. I think we can all be hard-headed every once in a while.
Right.
But you're talking about reading these books. You're talking about meeting people from all these different backgrounds. And you take these little pieces right. as you experience those other people. It seems like it was a big part of it as well.
Oh, major part. I mean, I think we're always in a constant state of learning if we're going to grow. And yeah, I was taking bits and pieces of everything. I've always been a sponge that way. And even when people may not thought I was listening, I was observing and learning and trying to figure out how to be the best me, and really defining who I am and what I am, and eventually even what it means to be a leader.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Leaving the Marines, your pathway into public life.
Sure.
There's a lot of parallels, leadership, discipline, but it is a different animal in order to be leading a community as opposed to in a military situation. So connect those dots between leaving the military and getting into public life.
Yeah, I never wanted to be an elected official, by the way. I didn't think I had the personality type for it. I'm still learning that there's not the military, so people don't do what you say just because you say do it. That there is a certain thing about collaborating with people and finding a common vision and working towards it. But I will tell you, when I left the Marine Corps, I went to school at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I really began my activism. I wanted to be work for a powerful politician as a chief of staff, someone in the background who was charged with getting things done, because ultimately that's where I thought my energy would be best served as it relates to serving others. And I learned a lot from organizing. I was a community organizer. I was a student organizer. I worked on campaigns, and I just caught the bug. And when I came to graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh, I wanted to take policy, real ideas around how to make things better for people, and then use the offices to kind of drive that. And so I started working for a local city councilman. And one of the things I learned, though, in those roles, if you are behind the scenes and your name is not on the door, it's hard. Even if you have the greatest idea, if that person whose name's on the door doesn't buy into it or has a different set of perspectives, it's harder to get things done. So I left that position and started to work for a nonprofit called Coral, whose whole purpose and mission is to train the next generation of civic leaders. And in this capacity, I got exposed to some brilliant young people who started to challenge me to do more to help pave the way for them. And really, I ran for this position really as a way to say to them, you don't have to wait your turn. If you have ideas or you have things that you think you can offer to the world, just go and do it, irrespective of if people say you can win or don't want to support you. And so I really did this as a way to kind of, I didn't think I was going to win. And I did it as a way to try to show them that even if you are going uphill against impossible odds, that you should still just do things. And I happened to win. And I ran against a guy who was a 14-year incumbent, who was a lifelong resident, who had been 8 years on city council, and he had $60,000. I had no money. I had no team. It was amazing. And I can't say I did it. I think it was just the higher being and people who wanted to have a change at the time. And it's like this old movie, The Candidate. When they told me I had won on election night, I had never been to Harrisburg. I didn't know how to get to Harrisburg. And I'm looking around. I'm like, what do I do now? So, but that's how I ended up being here. And then I had great mentorships. When I first got to Harrisburg, I had a friend who became one of my strongest advocates and a mentor. His name was Dwight Evans, who's now a congressman. And he set me down. He said, listen, do you want to be effective or do you want to be liked? Well, we all want to be liked, but I told him I wanted to be effective too. And he said, well, if you're going to be effective, then you have to be comfortable in your skin, sometimes standing alone, fighting for things that you want and for the people that you came here to serve. And so when you ask me the connection between the military and this, it's really that self-confidence that I gained while being a Marine, and especially as being a field radio operator, where I had to learn to listen intently and then take listening and then see what's around me and be able to guide people to hit a target. But I had to be comfortable knowing that I'm the only one who has the eyesight and the vision to see, and I have to trust my instincts to help do the mission. And it's the same thing with this. I have to trust my instinct. I have to be comfortable. I have to try to build teams and collaborate with people. But sometimes you have to be the force that is the tip of the spear. And so really, I learned some great lessons, and I'm continuously learning lessons. When I'm much different than where I was 15 years ago. People will tell you I came in like a raging bull, wanted to change the whole thing overnight. Now I have a lot more patience. I'm learning how to see the end before moving towards the end. I'm learning to be a better collaborator. I'm learning to listen more intently for what people are saying without saying. And I'm learning how to prioritize time and manage time more wisely.
That makes sense. I have so many questions in directions. I want to go to, but we need to just set some foundation for listeners who might not be familiar. You've been in this role for more than a decade. What part of Pittsburgh are you representing, and just kind of the basics of your district?
Yeah, I represent the 19th Legislative District, which is really the core of the city of Pittsburgh. So there are neighborhoods like the Hill District, Downtown, Uptown, Manchester, Fineview, Mexican War Street, Central Northside, Hazelwood, West Oakland, South Oakland, Beltsuver, Knoxville, parts of Mount Washington. So if you come to the city of Pittsburgh and you are enjoying a Penguins game, a Steeler game, or go to this casino, you're in my district. If you go to the University of Pittsburgh and in Oakland, you're in my district more than not. If you go over to our new Southside Works, or you're enjoying East Carson Street, you're in my district. So if you go over to Mount Washington and want to observe the skyline and the night lights, you're traveling through my district for the most part. And so I really have the core, and it's a really interesting district.
It's a happening place.
Yeah.
So I need to touch back on, now that we kind of have that context of the district that you were going after when you made this first run for the position,
right,
against a 14-year incumbent. And I think you demonstrated a lot of humility to say, whether it was grace or just the stars aligning, what have you. But there has to be
some degree of seeing an opening, like not that you knew that you would fill it and that you would get there, but along with the push that you maybe got from the Coro Fellows or what have you, you had to see that there was something that people wanted that wasn't being addressed, a voice that wasn't sure. being heard, that was your opportunity, that had to contribute to that initial success. Can you talk about maybe what it was that you identified at that point in time?
Yeah, I wish I was that strategic at the moment. I wasn't. It was one of those emotional responses, because I'll tell you exactly what kind of, at the time, this region had never elected an African-American to the state Senate, and we still haven't. And we had not elected an African-American to Congress, and we still haven't. And the gentleman who I was running, who was in the position, had circulated the idea that he might run for a state Senate position that had just opened up because of retiring a former active duty Marine who had retired from the state Senate. And I went to talk to him. And as I was talking to him, he basically, you know, said some very, I took it as mean-spirited things towards me. And when I left his office, I knew in my mind that I was running, and I didn't think I could beat him, but I wanted to show him that he didn't own the space around representing people and ideas. And so really, it was more about trying to, you know, open up democracy and have a competitive race where I was going to put forth ideas and maybe challenge his ideas and give people a choice that really sparked me to run. But it wasn't that I saw a victory, because I honestly didn't see a victory. But I saw openings, yes, of course. And if you, even me being here for 15 years, there are plenty of people who would probably say I've stayed well past my time, or, you know, I'm not as active as I should be or was, or there was some vote that I took that they didn't like. So the longer you stay in office, no matter who you are, no matter how great you think you are, there are always going to be openings for challengers to challenge you. I think that's the beauty of democracy. No one should get a free ride, because if we all are challenged, it all makes us have to come back to our constituents and prove that we are deserving of these seats. You know, these aren't ours. We're not born with the title of a state rep. You know, we are given this honor by people electing us, and we have to earn it each and every day, which is one of the reasons we call our office the people's office, to remind us and them that this office doesn't belong to Jake Wheatley. It belongs to the people of the 19th district. And every day I have to represent them. And every 2 years they get a chance to give me a report card. Either yes, I've been doing well and they want to continue to send me back, or hey, unfortunately, you don't meet the standards and we want someone else. So that's really that's the perspective. So we always have to prove ourselves. And at that point in time, I think the citizens of the 19th wanted something new.
Makes sense. As much as possible, a representative is, I'm using the same word here, representative of the tastes or the ideas that their region finds to be important. From a policy standpoint, can you talk through some of the big ideas or values or your platform as a public official?
Yeah, I'm a big education person. And when I say education, we all say we want to invest in education, but I want to change the way we deliver education. So I've always, the last 5 or 6 years of my career, I've really been looking at the system of how we deliver education. We haven't really changed this since its inception. And I tell people, this system is giving us exactly what it was set up to do, but it was set up to do it in a different era. We need to individualize and customize the experience, because now all of our learners, we are learning. We can wake up in the morning and we can customize a song list just for us. We can customize the videos that we see or the things that we want to learn. But our educational system doesn't allow us to do it that way. We treat every student learner as if they're a widget, that they should learn at the same pace and learn the same subject matter. It's not motivating. It's not useful. So we really are trying to figure out ways to change that. That's a major platform issue for us. That's a major area. We, jobs, working with people to in this area, we're told that there are going to be over 33,000 jobs that can't be filled because of the skills necessarily don't match the job and positions that's going to be available. So how do we retrain and reconnect people to those jobs? Because there's a lot of people who are underemployed or unemployed. And how do we retrain them and reconnect them? So jobs that pay a family-sustaining wage is a very important part of our apparatus. Community development. We talk about community and human development as if they are linked, because we do see you can't develop communities and not develop the people in those communities, so that what's being developed is something that they can access. So we use the five pillars of healthy communities, which we call your esoteric or spiritual health, your financial health, your mental health, your physical. Did I say physical already? Your physical health, and then your environmental health. So we look at that from a community perspective. We looked at that from a human development perspective, and we try to match it together. What type of policies are necessary? What areas are strong in certain areas and weak in other areas? And inside of that, you get little pieces like affordable housing. You get pieces around healthcare access and quality of the healthcare system. You get stuff about what are we doing in green spaces. So all of that becomes part of our policy perspective. So those are the three broad like strokes or broad based issues that we kind of really try to focus in on.
That makes sense. One of the this is related to the economics, and this is also related to the community development side, is something called Keystone Zones. Yep. Can you explain to people? We've talked with William Jenneret over a year ago back and covered this slightly, but can you talk a little bit about what Keystone Zones are and why they're important?
Sure. The state created these, I think back in 1999, as an economic incentive program to try to kickstart some of these underserved areas across the Commonwealth. And essentially all it is, the easiest way to kind of boil it down, I think there are 12 zones across the Commonwealth. And in these zones is a commitment from both the local and the state, where you're forgiving or in some cases eliminating taxes from being applied in these sectors to try to spur economic development. And so again, these are just a tool that our Department of Community Economic Development and others are using to try to attract businesses and development opportunities in these underserved areas, and to try to get them to generate economic activity, so that people who typically wouldn't have access to these jobs or markets or entrepreneurial experiences will have them. And so they've been very successful. I think there is a demand to even expand the program, which we haven't done in a while.
Right. And what's interesting about that is that when you kind of look at whether it's the startup scene or like a certain industry scene, they tend to cluster in a neighborhood or cluster in a region, and it can almost become its own entire structure, where you have the businesses and around those are all these new real estate developments for the people who work in those businesses to live, and their shops in the bottom of those businesses. And there's not this kind of integration neighborhood to neighborhood. Yep. And that is another interpretation that I've seen of these zones, where you almost entice or you force or you push businesses into new neighborhoods, which not only creates opportunities and creates engagement with these other neighborhoods, but also just what I'm constantly excited by is the relationship between being in a novel environment, being somewhere new, charting new course, right, and the creativity that inherently spurs. If you're talking with all people in the same industry from the same background who look the same as you, there's a degree of, well, we can get really specific on a couple things that we share in common, but what if we went outside of our circle of competence and took a new idea, a new experience, and sublimate that into what it is that we're doing?
Right. It's kind of like that creative energy coming together, and you never knew what the possibilities would be until you had these various opinions and experiences all mixing together. Again, using the example of the military, when you have all these different backgrounds that normally wouldn't be in the same room, and they come to the same room, and then you can create a common table for a common vision. You have all these different experiences, and it can take you anywhere, even beyond what you may have thought originally.
Absolutely. So I guess the last question you've kind of led me to here before we wrap up, Jake, you talked about there has not yet been an African-American representative in Congress, Senate, state Senate, and a couple of these other areas. You also alluded to being in this position for a while. Are there aspirations for other roles politically?
You know, I'm trying to perfect the one I'm in. I'm now the first ever African-American to serve as the finance chairman. I'm the Democratic finance chair. And so I'm still growing in that role and experience. I'm always open to looking at opportunities that I think that I can serve and be effective in serving. But I'm not actively trying to leave right now because there's some unfinished business. Again, before I leave this position, I want to have had an opportunity to really reimagine our educational delivery system. There are some community development projects that we have in the works that I want to see finished before I leave. But I think the opportunity to make sure there's a diversity of leadership in various positions so that when my three children get to their teenage years and their adulthood, that they won't still be looking for the first mayor or the first state senator or the first congressman who may look like them. I think we did a wonderful thing in 2008 and we elected our very first African-American president in this country. But it reminds me that it took us until 2008 to get an African-American who was competent enough that the world saw, that the country saw enough to invest in. And I think these types of firsts shouldn't be still around. I think we should have broken down all of those barriers. The same thing for women, same thing for openly gay, lesbian, transgender, all of these different labels that we have. I think the best thing for us as a society of people is to get from the first and get to the normalcy of seeing them in different perspectives and different ways so people don't have the same hesitancy around their impacts and their effectiveness. So, you know, maybe it wouldn't be Jake Wheatley, but I think this region is well past the time for this region to have way more diversity of leaders.
Absolutely. And especially as people continue to flow into the region, yeah, and stir the pot even more. I think that's a great point, great note to end on. Thank you so much for doing this. No, I want to make sure that people can follow along with all the work that you're doing. So if they're interested, what digital coordinates can we provide them to learn more?
Yeah, so my official Facebook is The People's Office. And literally, if you're on Facebook and you just look up The People's Office, you'll find us, or Representative Jake Wheatley. So I have two different pages, but you'll be able to follow that. And my personal page is Jake Wheatley Jr., so you can find that too. Twitter is at Representative Wheatley. And Instagram is at Jake Wheatley Jr.
Beautiful. We'll be sure to link that in the show notes for this episode. In addition, we'll be linking The Art of War and the Malcolm X biography that Jake mentioned. Any other books that you think people should be reading if they haven't?
Yeah, so I'm going to plug two books. One is a new book that I'm just now finishing. It talks about the history of the African-American contribution in this region, and it's called Smoketown. It's a great book if you want to find out what African Americans' contributions were in this region. And then the other one is Making Ideals Matter. Ideals Matter. It's a kind of a biography on my mentor Dwight Evans. He wrote this, and so he really talks about using how he leveraged his position as a state rep to effectively take ideas and then implement them in a way that really benefited the residents of his district. So I think those two are excellent books to pick up.
Cool. Well, like I said, all that will be linked to in the show notes, the links for Jake and the book recommendations as well. But as we do at the end of each episode, I want to give you the mic one final time to issue an actionable personal challenge for the audience.
Sure. I think, first of all, I think for any person that's out there listening, if you're not involved in your neighborhood in some form or capacity, I don't care if it's volunteering at an after-school program or choosing to run for an elected office. I think democracy demands all of our talents and skills to be actively involved in our society. And it does not start and begin with just running and voting. It starts with us getting outside of our comfort zone, coming outside our homes, and really trying to engage our environment, our neighborhood, and in real ways to see how we can use our skills and our talents and our perspective and our energy to make all of our lives better.
Absolutely. I think that that's one of the most common, after an emotional response, positive or negative, associated with an election, people often tend to say, like, well, I can only vote with this vote that I'm given once a year. But every day you're voting with your dollars, you're voting with your time. So I love that challenge. Thank you.
No, thank you.
We just went deep with Representative Jake Weekly. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey, thank you so much for listening, and please hit that subscribe button if you've not already done so on your podcast player. Additionally, it is not too early to get your tickets for the Going Deep Summit 2.0. March 23rd, 2019, we will be back in the city of Pittsburgh, have another great lineup of speakers, and an amazingly talented, ambitious room of people in attendance. We had sterling, excited, passionate reviews of our first Going Deep Summit, and we are going even bigger in 2019. Head on over to goingdeepwithaaron.com/event to learn more, including a intro to our first speaker, Mike Dariano. Really excited for it. Hope to see you there, and keep listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.